And we are live. Welcome, folks, to episode 3805 of the Survival Podcast. What am I reading here from Topcom? Maybe better titles, 10 Unusual Plants You Need for War and Rumors of War. Oh, okay, I get what he's saying. He knows that we're not going to get the attendance today or the downloads today that we got from yesterday's show called Wars and Rumors of Wars. That's Top Cone, and he's probably right about that. I get what he was saying now. Anyway, that's a comment for those of you that are in the audio going, what the hell's going on? A comment in the live stream chat. Remember, hey, you want to be able to join us for live stream chats? I have some suggestions. One, you know, bookmark or however you keep track of pages, tspclive.com will always tell you either the last one that already happened so you missed it or that day's new episode, when it will be live and all the places you can watch it. But the number one way that you can make sure you never miss it is get the Telegram app if you don't have it and subscribe to the TSP channel. The channel means you, if you don't want to have communications with the whole community and have it going off all the time, you'll just get the announcements from me. And every morning, usually an hour or two, to even sometimes 3 hours before I start, I send out information for the day about that day's stream, and that way you can be here. Of course, subscribe to us on YouTube and click the little bell, and then they probably won't tell you because we're shadow banned, but try it anyway. And if you have not subscribed to us on YouTube, if you have a YouTube account, even if you don't use it a lot, please do. It'd be great to actually grow our subscriber number. I feel like every time we do a push on it and the subscriber number comes up, all of a sudden it goes back down for no real reason, like somebody at YouTube is throttling that number. They don't ever want us to get to that $100,000 or 100,000 subscriber thing, which is crazy since the podcast itself's been well over that for years and years, over a decade, in fact. Anyway, with that, let's go ahead and tell you what we're going to talk about today. 10 unusual and new plants for your garden. 9 of these 10 plants are perennial, and the one that's not might be able to be such, or at least act like one. We will see. I guarantee you, if you are a long-term listener, there is some plants on this list you have probably heard me talk about before. Maybe you'll hear it a new way today or decide now it is right for you when it wasn't before. And I'm going to bet that the vast majority of people here, if you're not like a Nick Ferguson plant level geek or something like that, right, you're going to hear at least half of these and you're going to be like, oh, I didn't know anything about that, or I didn't know I could grow that here, or at least something like that. And if anybody gets out of here and it's like, I knew all 10 of them, I'm either calling you a bullshitter or really, really, really informed when it comes to plant types. And all of this is also stuff that's delicious, fills interesting needs in the backyard, and can grow in the garden, even though we're trying. I went for a perennial angle today. I didn't want bushes and shrubs and trees today. I wanted stuff that's more garden-like. And in some cases, it's perennial, but the perennial requires you to help. And so we'll be talking about a bunch of them today. Before we do that, let's go ahead and hear from our sponsors of the day. Sponsor of the day number one today, Joel Riles with K9 Academy. If you guys want to learn how to train yourself to train your dog, then you should get over to k9academy.us. If you can use my links, that would be great because I do have an affiliate agreement with Joel. But that's not what's really important to me. What's important to me is you guys go over there and give it a shot. He's got a thing called the Problem Solving Library. He just added a bunch of new free content to it. So if you had done the Problem Solving Library in the past, you know, maybe go back and check and see the new stuff that's now available in the Problem Solving Library. It's now up to 14 lessons that you can take, and you can take this one for free. And that'll give you an understanding of what it's like to take a class with Joel, and do you want to keep doing it? But I'll tell you what, if it was me and I was, you know, having trouble training my dog and I wanted to basically understand how to change that fast, I would go ahead and sign up for the K9 Academy Basics course. I would do that right out of the gate, and it will change your relationship with your dog for the better. I promise you that. Next up today, the Wellsteading Podcast with John Pugliano. John is one of us, guys. He really is. He is a prepper. He is a ham radio operator. He's got the stored food. He's got the garden. He even has a really cool mobile base of operations with his super light RV camper. Just a really cool dude. Reloader, bullet caster, but he's also an investment manager and a damn good one, and different than most. I met John in 2010 in Salt Lake City at a prepper convention. He came up to me. I didn't know him from Adam, and he said, "Hey, I want you to know I'm about to leave my old job, and I'm going to go full-time as what you call a financial liar, but I'm not going to be a financial liar. I'm actually going to do it the right way." And what I didn't know is he actually went about, 25, 30 feet away from my booth, stood there and watched me for 30 minutes to decide if he wanted to work with me. He wanted to know if I was the same guy in the real world as I was online. Turned to his wife and said, "Okay, I've seen enough. Let's go." And she's like, "You don't want to see that?" He's, "No, this is the only reason we came here." That just tells you the kind of guy he is. And what he does on his podcast is he tells you what he's doing with his money and his clients' money pretty much on a weekly basis. They're short podcasts. They range anywhere from like 8 to 20 minutes. Check him out. Again, it's at wealthsteading.com. It is the Wealth Steading Podcast, available on all the podcast services. With that, let's start getting into this. I want to start off with kind of like, what is the impetus for today's show? Why did I choose to do this show today? Well, number one, we're trucking headlong in the gardening season. It seems like just yesterday, I'm like, "Hey guys, January's over. You should be getting your seeds started for your gardens, and you should have them in the seed starting cups no later than Valentine's Day." And then Valentine's Day came and went, and some of you guys screwed up and forgot it, and your girlfriend or wife is pissed. That's your fault. I reminded you. Also told you to start your seeds. And some of you did, and some of you did not. Whoops. But these are all things that can be started relatively quickly, and they are all things that are perennial. So even if you're a little bit behind the power curve, establishing them this year is more than good enough. It's also the case that I find that most people that garden start out with like one or two small beds. 4x4s or 4x8s are very common. And when you do that, you have a surplus of plantings and a deficient amount of space. And so when you're doing your, you know, like one or two zucchinis will take up the whole damn bed. So you add in some peppers and some tomatoes, maybe a few eggplants and a cucumber or so, and you're kind of some beans, and you're out of space. And that's what everybody wants to grow, the stuff that we use all the time, maybe some lettuces or other leafy greens, especially in the cooler part of the year, in either, you know, the shoulders of the season, the spring and the fall. And, you know, if you're gardening four seasons and doing it through winter and all, you're well established and you know what's up. But what we usually do, if we get good success with those couple beds, we keep expanding. And eventually we end up with how many freaking tomatoes do I really need to grow a year? How many hot peppers? How many sweet peppers? How many flipping eggplants? You know, like you get to a point where like but I want to grow more. Variety is the key at that point. And having things that are unique, having things that not only are unique and unique culinary experiences for you, but for your guests, your friends, your family, people that come over, and be able to expose them to things that they just can't get anywhere else. We're not going to talk about this today. It's certainly not perennial. But an example with me is every year I grow nasturtiums. And I love having guests over and doing cool things using nasturtium flowers in a salad, or taking the ones I grow because of the fertility I have, the leaves on them are huge. And I basically make them like a wrapper to almost like a spring roll. And I'll do different things inside of them. I do escargot inside of them, which is snails, but not everybody will eat that. So I've tried other things, including some other fish-like things or mollusk-like things, and also completely vegetarian or some other stuff. Maybe less spring roll, more dolma, I guess, except they're not soaked in anything. Anyway, my point is it's kind of cool to give somebody something like that, watch them be a little bit skeptical, try it and go, "Wow." And they go, "Where can I get this?" And then go like, "Well, you have to grow it, or you have to come here to get it. And you can only get it this window of time in the season." Because like you guys up north, you can grow nasturtiums from once it gets warm enough until it freezes. I can grow them from about a couple weeks from now, be able to start putting them out. And I can grow them right up till about the beginning of June. They all turn yellow and die because they hate the heat that we have down here. So I have a window, you have a window, and all these things will fit into various windows. And it's like we're in the heart of the season now. Like if you're going to add new things this year, that decision needs to be made in the next few weeks with a few exceptions. But with, you know, in general, you got to decide now, especially if you have to start from seed, and some of the stuff has to be started from seed or tubers or things like that. So let's go ahead and fire this thing up and talk about our first thing. Now, this plant, I have the seed for it. I got mine from Baker Creek. I also want to let you know before we dig deep into this, there is a link, if you're watching the video, down in the video notes. That link will go over to thesurvivalpodcast.com with the post that goes with today's podcast. If you're watching it live and you click it right now, nothing will happen because we're not done yet. About 30 minutes after the live ends, that slide will go up with the audio download, the embedded video and all. But in the bullet points for all the plants, you have a seed source, a write-up with more info, and a YouTube video that goes along with it, none of which are my content. The YouTube videos are largely really great with one or two exceptions, which is because some of these plants you really haven't heard of, and there's not a lot of great content on them yet. So just so you know that you can find seeds or tubers, plants, whatever, for any of these things, more information and video. And I also have included the Latin name of all the plants as well. So as you're doing more research on your own, sometimes that will make finding things a little bit easier, or things that have similar names, you'll know you're looking at the right plant if you use that Latin name in your own research. So anyway, let's talk about these Delft Perpetual Leeks. As I said, I have the seeds to this plant in my refrigerator. Actually, no, I don't. I'm waiting on my seeds for this plant. I just ordered them. It's the Hamburg parsley we'll get to later that I'll tell you about that when we get there. Anyway, I am really excited about planting these this year. What these, because I love leeks and I love to make roasted leeks. I just don't grow a lot of them because they're considerably a lot of work to start every year, in my opinion, for something that doesn't cost that much. I saw these in a video on Facebook and went down, you know, the whole rabbit hole of investigating them. They were just simply bred to be a leek that is a dividing leek. So once you have one and it gets to a certain size, it looks just like a shallot or what have you, or a multiplier onion like we're going to talk about in a minute. It starts actually making babies by just dividing itself and putting off offshoots. And when you harvest it, you take the ones that you want and all the ones that you don't want, you separate and just stick them back in. If you've ever propagated something like daffodils, it's a lot like that. You're just separating and replanting and taking what you want. Again, leeks are delicious. They are a fantastic member of the allium family. And alliums in particular, one of the reasons I don't like to start them every year is allium seeds have a very low storage threshold. So when you get allium seeds, you want to get them as fresh as possible, get them planted as soon as possible. There's just extra steps to it, in my opinion. Now, these actually do produce seed as well, though, and if you take a look, like, they produce an awful lot of it. They produce a typical onion seed head. So you can let some go to seed and just shatter those seeds right into the surrounding area and let them self-repropagate that way as well. But you can also see how this is a picture here for those of you in the video. You've got a mother plant, big, thick leek like you want to eat, and then just got a little baby that's come off of it. So this is a relatively new plant. They're hardy to zone 6. And it says sometimes zone 5, and I found that pretty much all the few places you can buy these seeds from are giving that same kind of zone guidance for USDA zones. But I'll tell you exactly what would make the difference between 6 and 5 if you were in that area, and that would be really deep mulch, because as long as you've got a perennial underground bulb, as long as that doesn't freeze solid, it'll grow back. So good deep mulching would be how you handle that. But again, Delft Perpetual Leeks, these come out of the Netherlands from a breeding project over there. Next, I got one more allium for you before we move on from that. And later on, I have an allium impersonator. But right now, what I've got for you are something called potato onions. Now, there's actually this particular page is sold out. I will get you guys a different supplier in the links in the show notes. I actually think I do have one. I think that I select, nope, it is these. Okay, so I will have to get you guys a new supplier. But here's what you need to know about potato onions. First of all, they have nothing to do with potatoes. They don't taste like potatoes. They don't look like potatoes. There's nothing about them that's potato-like other than, just like the leeks, they divide, kind of like shallots do. So you plant that one bulb, as it grows and it starts to become a mature plant, it starts making children. And so when you are harvesting these, you harvest them like any onion, but you pull some of them and put them back in the ground. And I mean, you can just leave them and they'll keep propagating to a degree. But there is one thing to know about these. It's really important to know, especially those of you that have really wet, warm springs, early summers. As they mature and as they get all of those multipliers around them and they get that space in between them, you don't want to just leave these to keep getting bigger and bigger and bigger. You want to harvest them, separate them, and replant whatever you want to replant on an annual basis, because what will happen is they will begin to mold and mildew and rot because they are so close together, yet they are separate. So what will happen a lot of times when you pull them apart, you might see, like on that onion paper, some little spots of black. That's a mold that's starting to cause a problem. So you want to cull that out. And like I said, go ahead and replant them on an annualized basis, at least the ones that you want to continue to propagate. About the only other thing to know about them is they also tend to come in two particular kinds. You can see both of them in the picture there, and that is a white and a yellow variety. I have talked to people, I've never grown these, but I've talked to people, and they say, if you kind of like your typical yellow sweet onion, maybe not your super badass Georgia, but your typical yellow onion, you're probably going to find the yellow variety of these is very, very similar. The whites tend to be a little bit more mild and may not be what an onion person is really looking for in their cooking. So you do with that as you will. But if, again, if you look at the photo here, you can kind of see how they propagate. You've got one mother plant in the center. And in the case of this picture, for those that are audio only, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 younger bulbs propagating out. And it looks to me like even in this picture, there's another one you can't see underneath it. So that would be 7. Otherwise, they look and grow pretty much like any typical onion. They will put seed on, and you can allow some reseeding to go on as well. But these are actually really, really popular at one time. I mean, these were a huge crop for hundreds of years, and including early in the United States. Like, these were a big deal up until about World War II. In almost every backyard, people grew these and other similar types of multiplying onions, like walking onion and stuff like that. And as agriculture went into the huge green revolution boom post-war, they wanted to have crops that were easier to time as far as plant and harvest and uniformity, so that when you went out and planted a field and you were figuring out your economics on the other side of it, you knew that you would harvest on this date, this would be your approximate harvest in tonnage, and this would be your market rate, and that's why they did it. And we put that down a lot, but if you're planting a backyard, that sounds like it's really not important. If you're planting even 1,000 acres of mixed vegetables, or, you know, 100 acres of onions, that kind of thing matters. I understand, and they wanted a really storable product out of something like an onion, because it stores without refrigeration. And so these have all these little finicky things that if you're a backyard gardener, you don't even care. You can grow so damn many of them. If you have any that go bad, you just throw them away, or you stick them back in the ground. If they grow, they grow. And if they don't, they don't. But if you're trying to run a commercial farm, then this is probably not for you. Now, if you're running something like a small CSA, market garden, or whatever, this may work great. But they would not be what you would expect a onion farmer who's, you know, making significant effort in the production of onions to plant. And that's kind of why they went away. So this wasn't a conspiracy or, you know, Monsanto, as much as I hate those guys, are now bare, right? It wasn't any of that. It was just that the particular needs of the market shifted. And as that shifted, the home gardener who buys plants, who buys seeds, who buys things like onion sets, who doesn't self-propagate, tends to buy off of a market that is basically at the periphery of the commercial production market. So all of a sudden, you know, you go to the store and you can buy this little bag of 100 little bitty onion sets for, you know, sweet Spanish or something like that for $1 and stick them in the ground and be done and do that once a year. And you were good. So these kind of went away, but there's really a place for them to come back. And it's a good place for them to come back would be now. All right. Next up, we have Bloody Dock. This is one I have definitely talked about on the show before. This is one of my favorite plants to grow in hydroponics and aquaponics. Not really talking about it as a specialized thing today, but I wanted to say that because in either system, especially when you're doing something like deep water culture, or you're doing, I can't remember what they call it now, but when you're doing like the film where you're going to like the pipes, or you use rain gutters where NFT, whatever it is, where the water's flowing through and it's just a little bit of water going through at all times. In those types of systems, this stuff grows really fast. And a small pinch of seeds grows this beautiful big clump of baby leaves. And this is a high dollar product with chefs. Some people do produce this as a microgreen, but it commercially, it's much more viable, in my opinion, as a baby green. Once it's in a garden situation, though, it's a clumping divider. So it clumps and produces, and eventually it sends off little sister islands. And it's very easy, once it's well established, to kind of dig some of it up in a cool time of the year. You don't want to do this in the summer when it's going to get stressed, and divide it out and keep it propagating at a high level. It's delicious. It's good in salads. It's good. It's even good in soups and stews as a fun, like added at the end. It's got a bitterness that's actually quite nice. But where it excels is salads. It's very decorative if you take a look at it. Super easy to grow. If you're a microgreen grower, you're going to want to find a source other than this. You're going to want to find a place where you can buy seed by the ounce or something like that. But if you are just growing it in the yard, even one small packet of seeds, once you get it going, it's just a fantastic and easy to care for plant. And the small baby leaves on the top of the salad, along with some other things that kind of enhance the visual appeal, it really just hits. And again, if you're a commercial grower of any kind, this is absolutely worth considering as, again, a very high dollar plant that chefs, high-end restaurant chefs especially, really tend to like. And again, perennial. Once established, you almost can't get rid of it. Wait, here's another one. This one is very new to me. I've heard of growing parsley for the roots before. I have never heard of this particular variety of parsley that's grown for the roots. It's called Hamburg rooted parsley. This is the one I confused a little bit earlier. This is in my refrigerator right now. The seeds need to stratify, which means they need to be cold for a period of time before they'll germinate. That's like a germination trigger for them. So the instructions were to plant them like winter sow these. Plant them in like December. Just put them all in the ground when you get the packet and leave them. And they'll come up when they're ready. Since I didn't find out about these till a couple weeks ago, I've got them in the refrigerator stratifying, and I will plant them this coming weekend. But these guys look a lot like parsnip to me, and the people that I've listened to who have eaten these say that it is a parsnip-like flavor. Except unlike parsnips, it's actually pretty good raw, where most people don't really like a raw parsnip, and it doesn't get as sweet as a parsnip does. If you've ever, you know, added parsnips to a stew or something like that, it almost tastes like you put sugar on it. It's not quite as sweet as like a really sweet, like a Bogart sweet potato, but it's close. And so whenever I've used parsnips in stews and soups, it's always like one of my last additions. I just want them just softened. This supposedly is kind of like, you know, parsnips and carrots are really related, but they don't really taste alike. But imagine you had a parsnip that was a little less sweet and had carrot, like more carrot flavor to it. The leaves themselves can be used like any parsley, except they're not real strong tasting. They're much more mild. So this one, I'm not sure where I'm going to fall on this, whether I'm going to be really into it or not. Now, I did learn something else about it since I ordered my seeds, and I want to make sure I pass along things like this. This is a plant that will grow, you know, to a typical size of the parsley. And then in its kind of second push, I don't want to say second season because it is a biannual, but in some climates, biannuals will do their whole cycle in one season. And when it kicks into that second cycle to produce seed, this plant gets really big. Now, unlike a lot of plants that do that, the leaves just get bigger and taller. They don't really change form, and they're still edible. They don't get bitter. Like if you've ever had cilantro bolt and start producing coriander seed, right? Like once the leaf form changes, it tastes like feet. And it's just not good for anything except the seed. So this, the leaf would still be usable, though it'd be probably more than you would ever need. But what will actually happen is the root starts to disintegrate as it finishes its life cycle. And so you want to kind of figure out, based on your climate and everything you do, when the right time to pull it is. And it supposedly has a really intense kind of parsley undertone with that carrot-like flavor plus that kind of sweetness of the parsnip all in one. So that's one of those ones. This is like one of my true trial plants this year. There's years I grow something I never grew before, but I've eaten it before, I've tried it before, or I just know what it is and I know I'm going to like it. This one I don't know. This is kind of my plan this year to see, like, is this something to make a regular part of what we do or not? So do what you will with that. But I was only able to find that particular plant in stock with seed at Baker Creek, which is at rareseeds.com. Another real quick word before we keep going here. I have, a seed source or a tuber source for everything we have today. None of those are implied endorsements of the providers. They were just people that had them in stock and I could find them. And in some cases, they were the only place that I could find some of this stuff. Baker Creek, though, does get my endorsement. They are my crack dealer. I buy a lot of shit from them every year to try new stuff. Next up today is something called, are we going to offend anybody here? Are we? Caucasian mountain spinach. This is a vining crop. And I have eaten this, though I've never grown it. And I do not have any, and I'm not sure that I'm going to order any and grow it this year. I've got a lot of stuff going on this year, and I might be a little bit late to get this one in on top of everything else that we have. But I probably should grow it. It is used just like spinach. It is green. As a green, it can be used raw or cooked. It is a trailing vine, so it will climb up things. It is similar in its plant form to a plant like Malabar spinach, but it's not like Malabar spinach in any real way. It has far more cold tolerance than you would expect from Malabar spinach. Not just cold tolerance for perennialism, but cold tolerance to like not get sick, not die, not get really lethargic. It will grow down into the frost zones, and then eventually it will die back on a hard freeze. And it will regrow from the ground, and it is hardy to zone 3. Now, this is what you guys like me need to know, and this is why I probably won't grow it, is if I do grow it, I need to find the right microclimate for it. When you have something that's cold hardy to zone 3, it generally doesn't like zone 8 with blazing hot, dry summers. So zone 8 might be okay in of itself, but the blazing hot, miserable, dry summers, because you can be a zone 8 because you don't get that cold, but you still don't get as hot as other zone 8s. Like, the zone alone doesn't tell the whole story. So just know that if you are in a hot, dry summer climate, even if your winter, your summer, your spring are very moist, dry, hot summers, it's really going to need irrigation. It's going to need deep fertile soil, and it's going to need some shade. And the best place, I think, for any garden gets eastern sun and western shade. That would be more true here, and you would want maybe half the day in shade in a climate like mine for this plant. This is actually a edge forest plant. In other words, it grows in woods and forest lines in the edges, in glades, in places where you have openings. So it likes filtered shade even if in its native climate. So that would just be more true in a climate like southwest or south north central Texas. Jeez, I don't even know where I live. I've had a rough week with some of this stuff already. It's only Tuesday. Okay, next up is Mitsuba, M-I-T-S-U-B-A, Mitsuba. This is known as Japanese wild parsley. This does taste indeed like parsley, and that's how it's used, though it's used more as a vegetable than we would use our parsley. It is a perennial, so it will, again, come back for you over and over again. It's cold hardy to zone 5, no problem. With a little bit of protection, you can get down to zone 4 with it. It is highly prized in Japan and other parts of Asia. It is a staple crop in the backyard gardens of those people. And it is there's very little information about this plant in the United States. It, again, is another parsley, so it tastes like parsley, but it's a milder parsley flavor than kind of that really strong parsley flavor that we tend to like to use it straight as an herb. So imagine parsley that works well in a salad, right? In a significant amount. The leaves are also much larger than our parsley. It looks, again, like a flat leaf style parsley, but the overall size of the leaf would be about twice the size of, you know, the flat leaf parsley you would buy at the supermarket for cooking in your stew or what have you. Super easy to grow. Has a little bit of issue with initial germination. It's not a super high germination rate, but just go ahead and plant all the seed that you get right away. And this is also a plant that is used heavily in the world of making sushi. So if you're kind of a foodie and you like to do some authentic stuff, you might like growing this as well. Next up today, and this just what I'm bringing up for you as an image for those on the video just happens to be one variety. There's actually multiple varieties of these, and this is ground cherry. And I've talked about ground cherry a lot, but what I didn't know, there are perennial ground cherries. Now, I have been in and out with people on this in the past without being able to find anything that is specifically perennial. Because what a lot of people think is I planted a thing and I didn't plant it again and it came back, so it's perennial. You know, that's not how it works. There's a lot of plants in the world that are annual plants that somehow managed to survive before we humans showed up. And that's because they go to seed and they're in the right climate for themselves and they drop seed and they regrow. Ground cherry, at least some species of ground cherry, are native to North America. And there's pretty much a ground cherry species native to almost every part of North America other than the harshest deserts. And so when you create a nice little nirvana environment, like a garden, and you know, you're mulching all the time and you're watering all the time, and this little plant and ground cherries look like a little tomato with a husk wrapped around them. I think one thing people don't know, you know tomatillos, the tart, they make like green salsa verdes and stuff out of them. They have that paper around them. They're a big ground cherry. They're a species of ground cherry. They just don't have the sweetness that these smaller guys do. And so that husk is part of the plant's natural adaptation for reproduction. So Billy plants his, you know, Aunt Molly's ground cherry, very famous heirloom variety in his garden, and he literally likes them, and he doesn't plant them next year, forgets all about them, and then one day he goes out and sees this thing that's sort of tomato-looking but not, and then it starts, he's like, oh, that's another, and he goes, they're perennial, they perennialized in my garden. It's a self-replicating annual. But there are, so that would be, the plant drops its seed, the seed regrows every year. That's an annual, even though you didn't do the planting. Yeah. Now, when you have a plant that dies to the ground and it grows back from its original roots, that's a true perennial. This happens to be one of several varieties of true perennial ground cherries. Ground cherry is great for eating out of hand. It's also good for making like jams and jellies if you do that. I've never done it, but based on the flavor profile, I think it'd make an incredible mead or wine addition. Maybe not a standalone thing, but an addition to it. Kids love these things. And again, there's several varieties that are perennial. In fact, this site, Experimental Farm Network, I have a ton of links to them today because a lot of the stuff, they were the people I could find that had it. I've never heard of this company before. I am going to be reaching out to them to talk about, one, having somebody maybe come on the air with us. And the other thing I'm going to do is talk to them, of course, about a discount for MSB. Do not wait on me for that. Like, a seed provider is going to be somewhere in the neighborhood of 5 and 15%. Don't hold up your purchase on something you want to grow this year because of that. I cannot say that they're great service and great shipping or whatever. It's like ordering from anybody for the first time. I found these guys this last week. I have not placed an order with them yet. So again, it's not an implied endorsement, but I think they'll be pretty cool. And they have, a lot of these are sold out, but they have a New Zealand perennial ground cherry, a clammy ground cherry that's supposed to be perennial. They also have one called Elmer and one called Denver. And those are probably all worth, you know, kind of tracking down and seeing if you can find them. They also have a lot of other perennials, including a perennial wheat that you can try that for some reason is showing up in the ground cherry search, which is what I have up right now. But ground cherry in perennial format, this would be a fantastic thing to grow. Again, super sweet. I have never had a pest problem growing ground cherry of any kind, whether it was tomatillos, whether it was sweet ones, it doesn't matter. I have never had anything damage ground cherry. they usually drop their cherries or fruits, right? And they're not ripe. And the way you know when a ground cherry is ripe, like the husk will be kind of a vibrant looking color. It'll turn more like a dirty yellowy brown and get really easy to pull off. That's when they're ready and fully ripe. So if you don't want to leave them laying on the ground, what you can do is pick them up off the ground and set them somewhere to ripen before you pop the husks off of them. But they are absolutely fantastic. And again, even though they're like a super sweet, delicious treat, that paper husk does a really good job, because I've never even had problems with things eating them once they drop, unless they really start to completely ripen and over-ripen. And that seems like when critters really make a go for them. The next one, this is another one. This is also from this Experimental Farm Network company, which is, again, they're totally worth checking out. If you order anything from this company, again, they're called Experimental Farm Network. It's experimentalfarmnetwork.org. Usually, I didn't order yet, so I don't know. Usually when you order, there's a place in your order where you can put in notes. If you would let them know where you heard about them, that will pave the road for me really well if I go after them for a guest appearance and or an MSB discount. So the next one I have for you, again, I've never heard of this. And when I first heard about it and found it in my research, I'm like, I'm already growing that and it ain't so good. This is Ciambarde perennial Korean celery. Now, I'm growing a plant that's called water celery, and it's all right for what it is, but I have it only in one pond now, and it's a great aquatic plant for nutrient filtering and for cover, because it spreads out and it actually floats kind of like Ipomoea aquatica or water spinach does. The flavor, though, is just I didn't really find it to be that great. I can eat it. I don't hate it. It almost has a horseradish-like flavor to it, but very no heat. It's very, very mild. But it's a kind of a pain in the ass to prepare. So when I saw this, I was like, nah, I don't care. Then I found out it's not the same plant. It's not even the same family. When you look at the Latin name, it's not even in the same freaking grouping in any way, shape, or form. It's its own thing, and it does taste like celery. In fact, it tastes like a more flavorful celery, a little bit more bitter, a little bit more assertive. But if you've ever had lovage, which can be kind of like a perennial celery, it doesn't go. It's somewhere between a lovage and a celery. And my gut, because I've never had this yet, is it actually is going to taste exactly like celery, because that's what celery tastes like to me. When you grow celery like it's supposed to grow. The reason when you eat a piece of celery from the grocery store, it's that soft, sweet thing that celery can be, and it's like light colored all. But you notice that the outer stalks are dark green, and as you go in, they get lighter and lighter and lighter. That's because they blanch celery. And that can either be done by tying the bunch up as it matures, or more commonly with celery, what they do is they grow in very sandy soil. They put in a trench. They plant it at the bottom of the trench, and as the celery grows, they fill the trench in, and it holds the bundle together. And this is what keeps that sweet celery thing. When you grow celery the way the plant grows in nature, you get much more open stalks, more green, and you get more intense celery punch and celery flavor. And the stalks tend not to get as big, and they are more stringy. I think that this probably, if it was blanched, would produce some pretty sweet stalks. It also, though, gets huge, huge, huge. It gets huge. I've seen some videos, and there's a video in the show notes for you today of a guy standing, and he looks like a regular-sized guy like me, like 5'11"-ish, and it's above his head. And it produces your typical, like, oh, there's a picture of a dude right there. How about that? See, I didn't make it up. That guy's probably bigger than me. And it's got these huge flat-top flowers on him. Looks kind of similar to Queen Anne's lace, right? Or poison hemlock. So don't be going to forage this without knowing exactly what you're doing. But if you're growing it yourself and you know what it is, this apparently is another one of these things very, very big in Korea. It's also, unfortunately, and you can help by growing it and propagating it, an endangered plant now. It's been overutilized and overharvested. Yes, some Koreans grow it in their backyards, but it's mostly just foraged. It's a wild plant. It's had almost no breeding work done to it at all. And the big thing that has really pushed it, there's an island that I won't try to pronounce off the coast of Korea where it, like, this is like ground zero for this plant. And farmers on that island have used it to feed and graze pigs on, and pigs love it. So it's like Korean pigweed, I guess, is what some people also call it. It's also known as Ulang giant celery. So this one is definitely worth putting on your to try list. If you look at the structure of the leaf and the stalks, it looks exactly like celery that, you know, any celery that you would grow, except it's just a different plant, and it is a true perennial. Most celeries are not annuals, they're biannuals. And what I mean by that is what they'll do is they'll grow 1 year, they'll make it through winter and come back like a perennial, but very quickly after that, they'll send up these stalks, like on this image here, with flowers. They'll produce seed, and after they produce seed, they go to waste. They die. Where this plant keeps coming back from that main root system and also reproduces through division as well. So this is one I really recommend that you consider growing, because it's got a lot of things going for it. Anytime you can grow something that's perennial, that you'll use a lot, that's easy to grow, that's easy to propagate, and if you add to that that this plant is actually in its native climate endangered, and by producing it and creating a reserve supply of it, you're helping. I mean, what more could you ask for? Next one, and this, I cannot tell you where to get the seed that I grow right now for, or the tubers that I grow right now for. Everybody that has them is sold out, but there's lots of varieties of them. I have talked about this before. This is groundnut. Now, if you're tuning in from, Europe or Africa or Australia, everywhere other than the United States, a lot of people, when you say groundnut, they immediately think of peanuts. This is not peanut. Peanuts, of course, are not, they're a legume, and they are not a perennial. They can kind of be perennialized, but they're not a perennial. They don't come back from their own roots the way that this stuff does. And of course, with a peanut, you're basically eating the seed. A peanut, it flowers, it gets pollinated, and this little stem comes off of the leaves, and it bores into the ground like a root, and then that forms the peanut under the ground. So the peanut does not produce off of its existing roots. It plows these little, I don't know what they're called, these little like fingers into the ground, and then that's how it propagates. And so you're eating a seed. With this, what you're actually eating is the tuber itself, like a little potato. I've heard people say they taste like potato. I don't think they taste like potato. Maybe halfway between a potato and a water chestnut would be more accurate, without as much of the hydration that a water chestnut, they're not as wet inside as a water chestnut is, would be closer. But they also are a good source of something called inulin. So even though they are a carbohydrate, they actually lower blood sugar. Don't ask me for all the biochemistry. I studied it one time and had it all figured out, but I couldn't repeat it at this point. But inulin actually lowers blood sugar. And to even get at the carbohydrates in it, then it has to actually be fermented in your lower intestine. So it's a very slow release of the energy while it's also lowering blood sugar. This was a staple food crop of Native Americans. This was a commercial food crop during the colonial times in North America. It takes 2 years to really start producing, and you have to be selective with your harvest. So it didn't continue as a commercial crop. But there's two commercial crops that are very similar in form and format and function here, that were commercial in the New World and then ceased to be, maybe even a little bit before or just thereafter the United States became its own country. And those were groundnut, Apis americana, which is native to this climate, and Jerusalem artichoke, which I'm not going to go into today. These are really easy to grow. It can't be easier. You put a tuber in the ground, it sprouts, it starts growing, and it starts reproducing. And when you harvest them, as you pull one out, they'll pull out like a string. And like the one at one end will be the largest, and they literally are just a little bit smaller all the way along that string. To propagate them, you pull them apart and replant them. I wouldn't plant, you can plant the super tiny ones because they're not worth harvesting for food. I wouldn't rely on them to make sure that they're going to produce for the next year. Put a few of your really big ones back and put some medium sized ones back, and you'll never get them all anyway. There is one, well, actually two critical things to know about this plant in order to have success with it, because it's so easy, but so many people fail because they don't know these two things. Number one is that it doesn't want to be planted deep. I mean, when I harvest them, I don't dig it up. I go into the patches I planted it, and I just push my fingers a little bit into soil and rub it across the soil until I feel one. And I pull that, and I find that the strings attach them and try to pull that whole string out and then replant whatever I don't want. Like, that's how shallow they want to be, because that's how they grow natively. Number two, if you were foraging for these in the wild, and they do grow because they are a native plant species, the place you want to look are the banks of creeks. That's where they grow. And the shady banks of creeks. And the reason that is the case is they do not want to be in muck, but they do not ever want to be dry. This is a plant that loves moisture. It is a what you would call like a shelf species plant, a semi-aquatic plant, aquatic adjacent. I don't know what the right term is for it, but it wants to have moisture. And if it doesn't have moisture, it gets really sick and the top dies. It can still come back as long as the tuber makes it. Once the tuber dries all the way out, it is done. And it needs to be shallow and it needs to be moist, because there's no such thing is deep roots with this plant. Not only does that tuber want to be shallow, there's almost no roots beyond the tuber. There's like these little hair roots that come out, but there's no deep roots. So if it's sitting in dry soil in the first 2 inches of the bed, and you can have a plant next to it, you know, like a tomato, where the roots are going down a foot, and that tomato's totally happy and it doesn't give a shit, this'll die. So I grow these a lot in like wicking beds and things like that, that would never, ever, ever go dry. And the other thing you need to know about them, they are a vining plant and they vine a lot and they climb a lot and they wrap around everything. Do not put them into a bed with really much else of anything. They will completely take over. They'll act as a ground cover, but they'll also climb up things. So if they're going to be around something, they need to be around something that can handle being climbed on, or you're going to have to be really meticulous about pruning them off. Basically, I grow one bed of these. It's about a 4x4 wicking bed. The only thing I grow with it is bee balm. And when I planted the bee balm and them together, I didn't know what I just told you. So the bee balm manages, but it's not the plan I would have from the beginning anymore. The bee balm is so tough. It's so aggressive that it always manages to get up and out, and I get bee balm for tea and stuff like that. And real quick, if you have a question for me going through this, do it just like Scott King here did. Question in all caps. And if I see it, I will star it to talk to you about it later. Next up, what do we got? We have, oh, you're going to like this one. This one was new to me. And wow, we're almost done. I'm trying to make the shows not 2 hours anymore, guys. I really want to try to get back to the 45 minutes, hour and a half shows. Anyway, this is known as society garlic. And I found this one today. I don't know if you know, if you're a longtime listener, if you're aware of the fact that I have some quirks, I guess would be the term. I have some character traits, annoying characteristics. I have certain things that, but autistic spectrum syndrome, I don't know. I like things to be round numbers, like eights and tens, but I don't like nines and 11s. Okay. So I had 9 plants. I'm like, I gotta find something that nobody knows about. It's gotta be edible. It's gotta be perennial. I gotta find something new. So I found this plant today, and then I realized, dumbass, you know this plant. You just didn't know you could eat it. Again, it's called society garlic. And the reason that they call it that is, even though it tastes like garlic, apparently when you eat it, it doesn't make you smell like garlic the way garlic does. Now, I've never actually found garlic to be off-putting personally. But I guess if I was kissing somebody and they just had a big mouthful of garlic, maybe that would be a little off-putting. But that's the source of the name. When I started digging into it, I'm like, damn it, it's just a different name for a plant that I grow all the time, and so it's not going to work for that. I ended up being wrong. It looks a lot like garlic chives, but garlic chives is actually an allium in the onion garlic family. This is not. If you wonder, like, I kind of looks familiar. I feel like I've seen that plant before or something like that. It's because you probably have. And you've probably seen it looking more like it does right there, like an ornamental. It is widely grown as an ornamental. This one, you can buy seeds from one of the suppliers I gave you today, but you might find that that's completely unnecessary. You might find this at like a Home Depot or a Lowe's or a Callaway's nursery. And what it is fantastic for is anywhere that you would normally plant, let's say, an ornamental grass, a clumping grass, something like a mondo grass or something like that. And very similarly, that it kind of likes like a dappled shade environment. It doesn't really want to be sitting out in the middle of a field with the sun blazing on it. So this is an edible landscaping plant. This is grow it right in front of the Karens and the Karens don't get upset plant. And you would use it exactly like garlic chives, except you can also pull it up. And you get these little, like, almost like small leek garlic-flavored stems going down to the root on this plant that are useful as well as the greens. And I guess you can do that with garlic chives, but I've never seen anybody do it. It can be easily propagated once you have one or two of them going by digging it up and dividing it and replanting it, and it will grow into another clump like this. Now, this is the big difference, though. You see those pretty flowers on it? Yeah. Now, you can eat the flowers that are on a, let me try to blow this up for you here. Right there. Okay, you can eat the flowers that grow on chives and onions and things like that, but they're kind of papery and they're not very pretty. They're just like these white little papery flowers. The flowers on this taste like garlic and they're like a really pretty purple. There's also some other colors. Though, if you get anything other than the stuff marketed it as edible, do some research, because I just found this plant, and I don't know if maybe there's some varieties, and they're sold as this, and they're not really, like, I don't know, right? So find out for yourself with that. But the ones that are designed to be edible, or are known to be edible, I should say, with these purpley-blue flowers on them, are just a gorgeous landscape plant, but they have edible flowers. I know I'm supposed to be Mr. Big Survival Guy, but I like edible flowers. I think being able to put something like that on a salad is fantastic and be able to do it late in the season, because right now we do have a lot of wild garlic on my property. Anytime I go anywhere, if there's wild garlic that sets little bulblet heads, I bring them home and I cast it all over my property. So I've got like four or five different forms of wild garlic or wild onion. It's debatable what they really are. Most are called wild onion. They smell and taste more like garlic to me than onion. But I will, in the spring, pull flowers off those for use in our salads. But it's a very narrow window. It's like a couple weeks that I can do that. These you can do like that all through the season with. So now you've got a plant that's edible, perennial, looks beautiful, and can be used in standard landscaping. Pretty cool. So I know some of you guys are actually in the business of doing things like that for other people. And if you didn't know about this one, I wanted you to know about it. So there we go. We've kind of hit these 10 plants. I only see one question from the audience today. So if anybody else has a question, please go ahead and ask me. Just put question in all caps and I will get to it. Try to be on some level of the topic of today's show. Don't ask me about the cartel in Mexico or the Bitcoin price today, right? It was something at least in the garden. But Scott King is the one question I see here. Would American groundnut do well in a sub-irrigation system? I don't know what you mean by sub-irrigation system, if you want to explain that. Well, I'm waiting to see if you'll respond to me and let me know what you mean by that. Let me again explain what it wants. It wants damp, shallow planting, and it likes some shade. It doesn't want to be fully shaded, but it likes some dappled shade. It definitely doesn't want to sit in the sun all day long. You want some point in the day, and the later in the day, the more intense the sun, that shade comes in, it would be the optimum time for it. So sub-irrigation, I don't really know what you mean by that. Are you talking about like in a septic field? Because I wouldn't do that, if that's what you mean, because it is a tuber growing in the ground. It would probably do fantastic, but I don't know that I would want to grow a underground edible tuber in a septic leach field, if that's what you mean. So let me know what you mean by that. Or sub-irrigation, wicking bed. Yep, that's exact. Okay, wicking bed. As I said, yeah, that if that's what you mean, absolutely. That's where I grow mine. I have these 4x4 fiberglass tubs that they were formerly used to feed molasses to cattle. I got them from a buddy. I built a 4 wicking bed system with flow through wicking bed back to a tank, and that's where I grow mine. And they love the shit out of it in there. I will also tell you that the garlic chives are in one, and I really wish I didn't put them in there. They have completely. I've been unable to remove them. I do keep them under control, but I've been unable to get them 100% out. They've gone very weed-like on me in there. So if you just wanted a tub full of garlic chives, sub-irrigation would be the way to go with those. And that makes me wonder if the Society Garlic would do really well there as well. Next up, I got Renee asking me or commenting. I haven't heard of any of them. I am a plant person. Well, I'm glad I was able to do that for you. I really tried to, like, there's some really cool perennial stuff in the garden that we've talked about a bunch. And I tried to, if it was previously covered heavily, except for a few things, I didn't want to talk about it today. So, Renee, I'm glad I was able to do that for you. Hey, Alabama says, would these plants grow well in a greenhouse or a high tunnel? Well, we covered 10 different plants, so I don't know. Any plant will do well in a greenhouse or high tunnel if you adjust the conditions inside to the condition the plant wants. Many of the plants we talked about today actually like cooler, shadier areas. So if you have a shaded area of a greenhouse, right, if you have a well-ventilated greenhouse in your warm season, many of them would do well. If you have a specific plant in mind or specific reason for asking that, go ahead and follow up with me, and I'll do what I can for you. Anyway, with that, I think we're done. I'm going to go ahead and say it this way. I'm going to do my item of the day for you. And when I get done with that, I'll come back and take another look at the comments. And if there's any more questions or comments for me there, I'll handle those before we close down today. So today's item of the day is one I have brought around a lot, and it has nothing to do with plants or gardening at all, except, you know, I like to listen to music and audiobooks and podcasts when I'm gardening. And it is the Anker earbuds that I've been recommending a lot through the end of last year and into this year. They are the V20i open ear headphones. These sell on a retail price of around $55 to $60, but they keep putting them on sale. And they're on sale today again, and they're knocked down 40% down to like $29.99. The sound quality of these, I would put right up against, like, you know, Apple AirPods, kind of your mid-grade Beats and things like that. Now, I'm not an audiophile. There's a lot of times people are like, can you hear that? No, I don't, man. I'm in my 50s, and I had a lot of things blow up around me in my life, and I'm just happy that I hear sound at all. But to me, they have great sound. The big thing with them they have, though, is the open ear thing is something a lot of people are into now. Me, it's more that to have the open ear thing, they have to have the hook that goes around the back of the ear. I have a whole bunch of cases I just need to throw away of earbuds that you stick in your ear, and if you open the case, there's one earbud in there. Could be the right one, could be the left one. Generally speaking, it's the right one. And the reason is that when I go outside and I'm, you know, doing my daily thing and stuff like that, and I've got an earpiece in, there's something, I guess, wrong with my ears. I don't know what it is. And they literally seem to not just fall out, but like leap out of my ear. And when they leap out of my ear, they seem to leap out of my ear into things like small garden ponds or really deep grass where I can never find them again. And so I don't buy those anymore. And I either wear actual headphones or I wear the over the ears. And these are the best quality ones I can find that don't cost a freaking fortune, even at full price through a deal. So I really recommend you pick some of these up, because I keep saying they're going to get canceled. And I keep feeling like I'm wrong, and I keep feeling like I need to apologize for them not being canceled. I don't want them to be canceled. I just ordered another set of them and put them on the shelf unopened. They're going to eventually do it, though. Every time Anchor does this, and they take a product like this, and they put it on these deep discounts, they're liquidating inventory. I guess they just have a shitload of these things. So if you want a really good over-the-ear Bluetooth earpiece, this is what I would get. Yeah, they show up a little bit more than a little bitty ones to stick inside your ears. If you want those, Anchor makes some great ones. By the way, the company itself, Anchor, is the best discount electronics brand I am aware of. I hope they stay the value brand that they are, because when I first found them and first started bringing them to you, you would never find an Anchor product in a store, right? You wouldn't find them at a Best Buy or at a Costco or something like that. Now they're everywhere. They have really grown because of that reputation, and I'm hoping they stick in that value brand market where they're not the cheapest thing, but they're not selling at like stupid premium either. They're sitting in that middle, but you're getting the premium quality for a value price instead of a stupid cheap price. And that makes the price kind of feel stupid cheap for the quality you're getting. The other thing you need to know about Anchor, with all of their earpieces, all their Bluetooth stuff, they have an app now that gives you a massive amount of control, like EQ and stuff like that, of all their devices. And you set up a profile per device. So if you switch to like the speakers or back to your earbuds or whatever, you can control those devices individually. That's free, and it's available in your app stores, either Android or Apple app store. So just wanted you guys to know that. Let's go ahead. I got a few more things came in while I was doing that. And Scott said, if you have soil in a bed that has been invaded by something that you can't get rid of, you can build a big solar oven and use it to sterilize the soil. Yeah, you can. I don't want to do that to that bed, but yeah, you're right. Plastic, clear plastic film will do that. However, it takes a lot to kill things that are deep down in the soil. And those garlic chives, part of what makes them hard is you end up with the bottom of that bulblet being about 4 inches deep. So if I wanted to do that, I would probably remove like the top 3 to 4 inches of soil and then cook it. I really don't want to do that to my bed, though. I'll just, you know, garlic chives, there's worse things to have in your life than garlic chives. I just want to let people know that they will do. In fact, I have them all over the friggin' property now. They do go to seed, and I don't always stay on them. And, you know, like, they'll end up growing at the base of the bed because it's an elevated bed. And then they'll go to seed, and God knows where those seeds will end up, with ducks and everything else carting seed around. But that is true. You can take that solarization process. Renee says, I just planted some perennial broccoli called Rob. I know what broccoli Rob is. I did not know. And Rob, for on the people that aren't in the video, is R-A-A-B. It's not R-O-B like Robert. And I like broccoli Rob. I was not aware of the fact that it is perennial. So I'm going to have to look into that. Thank you, Renee. I appreciate that. Knowledge exchange should be a two-way street. And next up I have here from Maryland. Would you consider doing a show about what to grow in the high desert of Wyoming? A lot of the stuff I gave you today can be grown. It is not my climate type. I don't know much about very cold, windy, high deserts. So I can maybe put some research into it and do my best for you. The thing is, I'm drilling down to a very small niche subset of the audience. And I also do not have the knowledge firsthand. I have to go acquire the knowledge for maybe something that 5% of the audience would really be interested in. So what maybe I should do, Marilyn, that would be more applicable to everybody, is how to find plants for your climate no matter what it is. And maybe we could even make that a learn to learn with AI show. because that's where I would go with that question. And I would not trust AI because it's going to give you the textbook answers, right? But that's a good starting point, but it's not a finishing point. When I worked with Dave Jackie in the past, first thing he told everybody was plants don't read books, not even mine. So the book is a starting place, and then you figure out what works through trial and error and observation and feedback. So maybe I can do something for you there. Dark Horse says, are we moving from Discord to a better privacy respecting alternative like Matrix? Bro, I don't know. If there can be a person who's going to throw some bullshit question at me that has nothing to do with what we're talking about, it's going to be you. It's going to be you. Anybody's like, man, you're picking on that guy. Hey, it's years of this. Years of this, bro. Years. If you want something other than Discord, talk to the people that run the Discord server. I don't run the Discord server. I will say this. If you're communicating on any sort of social media type thing in a group format, even if it's completely and fully encrypted, if it's a group format, like people are let in and then they're in, and you expect privacy, you're not very smart. You're not very smart. So Telegram, you know, you can do fully encrypted messaging on Telegram. They don't have it in groups. And the reason is as soon as you go to a group, if it's like five people of your own private group, right? Okay, that's different. But when you go to a group that like people, like a guy has a show and he sets up a community and people come to ask to get into that group. And basically the threshold to letting them in that group is what? Are you a spammer? No, you can. Do you know anything about the community? Like, do you know who? A lot of times on Telegram, they'll be like, okay, you know, they'll ask a question that you should know if you listen to the show. And they don't know they nuke them because it's for the community. It's not for anybody interested in survival. But that's a pretty low threshold. So I guarantee you there's somebody from fucking Langley in our TSP groups, right? Maybe not our alum group because you got to come to a workshop for that. But I'm sure the CIA could front the bill for $650 for a workshop for one of their ops to come in. If I was really that, I don't think I'm that important, but I guarantee you there's somebody monitoring just about everything. It's a group. So if you want actual end-to-end encryption in a message format for a select group that you control, you want a Star9 server. You don't want any public asset like a Telegram or a WeChat or whatever the hell else it is, right? Scott says, I would love a show on how to choose plants for your area. I think it's a great idea. I think it's a way to give Marilyn what she wants without doing a show that's only for 5% of the audience that I have to go learn something that I'll never use to do the show. But I could probably pepper in like, I got an idea how to do this, is kind of break down the U.S. into the primary grow zones, not the USDA zones, but things like high desert, things like subtropics, right? Because, you know, there are places in Texas that are USDA Zone 8, and there's places in Washington State that are USDA Zone 8. And the Pacific Northwest and Central Texas are very different growing climates, even though they're the same zone. So then maybe I could have like one or two plants per zone as example plants of what works there and why, and use that to help people narrow down what works for them. I think that's a great idea. And I love when this happens. When we get everybody kind of working together to figure out where we go with a new show. And I would love as much of that as possible. I want to say a couple more things before we wrap up today because we did keep the time down. One, I have heard from quite a few people interested in editing my next book. And that's great. And I need one. So I'm going to wait another day till, because, you know, when I put out a show, like, it'll get a huge amount of downloads the next day, usually. Like, you get a pretty big hit the first day, but it's usually the day after that you get this big download. But then feedback will come in heavily from it for about a week, because not everybody, like, instantly listens. I'm not that important in people's lives. We're like, oh, Jack said something new. Let me listen, right? So it takes a while. Like, what I put out on a Monday, I'll still be getting feedback from into that next weekend. So I'm going to kind of let that drift a little bit, and then I'm going to look through what's been proposed, and I'll email a few of you guys and say, hey, we'll do some back and forth, and I'll pick somebody to do it from there. But if you're interested in serving as an editor for my next book, Laws of Life 2, just to be clear on what I'm looking for, too, because I can tell some people get it and some people don't by the emails that came in, I want to send the manuscript to you. I want you to send it back to me, and that's it. I don't want to have long discussions about it. I don't want it all marked up so that I fix it. I want to send it to you. You fix it and we go on. And if there's, you know, there might be a few cases here and there throughout the book where you're not sure if I'm going to be okay with it. And you can ask, you want to do it a chapter at a time? So I look at like the first chapter and go, yeah, you did good. Fine. But it's a big project. It's about 120,000 words. It will be in good shape when you get it. I've been through it three times. There's not a lot left that's obvious error, but I know me, and how I write, and I do miss things. Maybe it's the one I don't know. But there'll be things also like fixing run-on sentences. That's pretty much fixing run-on sentences. Make sure there's no, you know, homonyms that are wrong. And if it's like, it should be three sentences, but I made it into one, make it into three sentences. That's kind of where we'll be with that. You will be listed as the editor in the book. The person that does this, I would hope, would be someone who would want to do it more than once, because I'm fixing the first book as a second edition. And once I get done with that, that will also need the editing treatment. And then I have a third book coming out, and I'd like to make this person kind of my editor du jour, my editor of choice, so to say. And it will never make you rich, but I am trying to figure out how to set this up so that, you know, I give you some money in the beginning, because you have no idea how long you wait as a self-published author before you get your first penny out of it. But then like maybe an advance and then a small piece of the book sales on profit for like 5 years. So depending on how well we do with it, it could be quite lucrative long term. Renee says, I love this topic. Thank you. Bye, guys. Bye, Renee. And we got one more comment here from Scott before we go. I have no interest in editing your book, but I know a good editor. She's a penny a word. I don't want her. I do not want a good editor who is, it's not even about the price. It's not about the price. I don't want somebody that doesn't know who we are and what we do. I want someone mission oriented. People like that tend to be the people that you get it back and go, this is not what I said. I've been through that before with other books. I don't want that. So I appreciate it, but that's, and for anybody out there that's throwing your hat in the ring, I don't want people changing things. I don't want your editorial input. And I don't really agree with what you said here. I'm not interested in that. I want correct English and punctuation and grammar. That's all I'm looking for to make sure we get out of this book. With that, I appreciate it. Scott, I'm not crapping on that or your person. I'm sure she's very good at what she does. Just not what I'm looking for. With that, thank you guys for tuning in today. I really appreciate it. Hope you enjoyed today's show. And if you tune in tomorrow, we will have an interview. And that interview will be with someone you guys know pretty well. It will be really high energy. Any idea who it is yet? Super high energy. You might get a contact high from listening to him, but like a sports high, not a drug high. Of course, I could only be talking about who? Andy McCann. Andy McCann will be with us tomorrow. And I actually am going to have a lot of the expert panel on in the coming weeks. I sent out an email to them this week saying, hey, I think it'd be good for all of you, but especially those of you who've only been on the air once or have never been on the air. We have some relatively new people that have never been on the air for a standalone show on the Expert Council. We'll have them coming on. And I'll throw it again. We are looking for guests. I have had a lot of people apply to be on the air in the last month. Usually I take about 8 out of 10 applications. Because I just get good potential guests. This last month, I have gotten a shitload of people who want nothing more than access to my show to produce an infomercial and get at you guys, my audience, to try to sell you shit. I never begrudge a guest getting a good pitch for their product, their brand, or whatever it is they do if they have one. But I am not looking for infomercials. I am not looking for people trying to just build up their marketing. I mean, marketing is important. We teach people how to do it, right? You need that. You need the exposure, and I want people to get that. But I want a guest that comes in. I want 90% of what that comes out of their mouth to benefit this audience, whether that person buys them or not. And it's actually in their best interest as well, and some people can't comprehend that, in that the guest who comes in and informs the shit out of you, you will be very likely, if their product works, for you to do business with them. The guest that comes in and does nothing but push their product at you for an hour, which will never happen because I'll get rid of them if that starts to go that way and I was wrong about letting them on in the first place, you don't want to deal with. You don't want, you know, we're not looking for a 1 a.m. 1990s infomercial here. So if you have a product that you want to get exposure for and you want to get on the air, the key to that is to format your pitch, which is filling out the guest form and the questions and the bio from a standpoint of educating people about the market. I just had a guy on not so long ago. We talked about mushrooms. He has a business. He got a full pitch. He got business from us. I've already heard from him. He's also now going to be speaking at Nicole's. Because he did such a good job of being an information-rich guest, I introduced him to Nicole and suggested him as a speaker there. And he's also now hooked up with Matt Powers, which is a pretty big deal, at least for really for anybody in the space, but especially for him. He specifically said, I've been trying to get in touch with him. Oh, fine, done. So I'll help you that way, but you got to help the audience. And I'm saying that now, not just for prospective guests. I always want my audience to know what I do for them. I always go to bat for this audience. My first thing, when anybody wants access to my community, whether it's on the air, they want me to mention them in a blog post, mention them in an episode, something like that, I want to protect my people first before I worry about what it does for me. Because I've found in doing this now almost 18 years that is the real key to success as an internet personality. I may never be as big as some of these people that are out eating Tide Pods or whatever it is they do, or chicks showing their ass or whatever, or people that are all in on the politics all the time. I don't care about that. I care about taking care of this audience because you guys have taken care of me for almost 2 decades. I have lived the life I want because of you, so I will never let anything in your direction that I don't think benefits you highly, because if I don't do that, I don't deserve you. I'm not worthy of you. Just wanted y'all to know that. I say it once in a while, but I probably don't say it enough. Thank you to all of you. I really appreciate you. Take care. I'll catch you guys tomorrow with another episode. Run you round. They said you should have a house the American way. $1 down, $1 a month, and you never have to pay. There's a better way. Let me show you a better way.